facing is probably the broadest that we've had and at, up to this point, but I think it's one that I've been anticipating a lot this for the past couple of months, and that is, what are the greatest issues facing Christians today? What are some of the biggest issues that are facing Christians today? And you'll see from the couple of introduction questions and everything we have for Dr. Klaus, it's going to be a great night. So our guest tonight is Dr. Byron Klaus. He is Assemblies of God Theological Seminary president. I believe he came there in 1999. He's been serving there for a while. Before that, he has served in churches in California and Illinois and Texas, I believe, and then also worked for many years with Latin American Child Care, just a great friend, but great scholar. He's what, in my opinion, he's one of the great guys to talk about context and culture, and just a good friend. But more than all that, he's a great friend of Central's. He's a member here, one of our friends, and I really appreciate the influence that he's had in my life with the seminary training and everything. He's just a great guy. So would you do me a favor and welcome Dr. Byron Klaus to the stage. Thanks. Welcome. Welcome. Yeah, right there. Let me scoot this a little. I think I'm in your personal space. My bad. So that's the way I see it. Anyway, that was bad, wasn't it? Yeah, anyway. So, man, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here this evening. And I thought maybe just by way of introduction, we could just do a little, where in the world has Byron Klaus been? So maybe you want to tell us a story, maybe some great place, far off place you've been, or I don't know, maybe you've just been in Springfield, who knows? Yeah. But where in the world is Byron Klaus?
I grew up in a little town in North Dakota, and grew up my entire life having as a goal taking over my grandfather's farm. And obviously life took me other places, Lord took me other places, but when I moved to Springfield, I now live on a small farm about 10 miles north. Uh-huh. And I have a whole group of good old boy friends that have nothing to do with theology or anything like that. They, you know, enjoy their skull around me and things like that. They like try to impress me with how far they can spit and things like that. And you know, it's part of what I do to disconnect from the usual things that I have to do. That's my responsibility. I mean, I have to work hard to be around non-believers.
Right.
That's and so this is part of my life. And last Saturday, I had some extra hay that I didn't need, and I was taking it to a fellow guy who needed it for his cattle. And I thought, you know, I thought I was able to move 1,000-pound bales by myself, and that was not true. And so I had to go get his 16-year-old son to come, and you would have not recognized me after I finished that process. So I've been in exotic places, but last Saturday I was hauling hay for a friend. So not really exciting, but that keeps me sane.
That's awesome. And so, tough questions facing Christians. So do you address their dipping problems or skull, or do you suggest
No, I just stand out of the way.
Oh, that's good. Standing out of the way. That's good. Well, that's awesome. So you kind of come full circle. You live on a farm.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And do you have cattle? And
They're in the freezer right now.
Okay. Yeah. That's how that works.
The best place.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, again, it's great to have you here, and this is our last Tough Questions night. And when we were receiving questions a couple of months before we launched this series, a lot of the questions that came in had to do with the difference between a Christian and the lifestyle of a Christian and a non-Christian, and why sometimes there are no differences, and why sometimes you know, you've got two Christians working together, let's say in a place of business, and then, you know, over a water cooler talk, one is maybe having a not-so-godly conversation, giving up a bad witness, if you would, for Christ, and then this puts the other Christian in a difficult place. of they're mad, they're angry, and yet, you know, what do they do with that? And so there are some, I think, some big issues. I mean, who among us has not at one time or another been critical of the things that have gone on in church? To be perfectly honest with you, I enjoy socials and rock and roll music. I kind of wish we had more of them in church. But, you know, these are not just personal preference questions. We're talking about big issues. And some of the illustrations or the analogies that I've heard of the current state of Christians in a non-Christian culture, something like, you know, the church is kind of like the Titanic. You know, it's a big ship unaware of its fate. Maybe it's like a powerful amplifier being undermined by poor wiring and poor speakers. I've heard that. An ostrich with his head in the sand. You know, I've been personally told before, I don't want to go to your church and I don't want to be a Christian because all Christians are hypocritical. Christians are judgmental. They're sheltered. They really have no idea what it's like in the world or in the real world. When you have sort of absorbed and processed all of this information yourself, and I think it's great to have you here because I think you've had a wide experience, even globally, of how Christians act and interact in the world. What have been some of your responses and your own heart? Maybe you've said them before, I'm not really sure, but what would you say, as you have looked at all this information, can you help us understand and clarify why we're facing the issues that we are today in the church and in Christians, our personal lifestyles? What would be like a foundational response that you may say to that?
Yeah, I think that it's a standard conversation. When people find out you're a follower of Jesus, to, in a sense, insert a perception, in many cases, a stereotype. And I think that sometimes we don't want to own up to the fact that some real jerks represent us in places we would rather not them represent us. I think you've got to just sort of take that in and say, you know what? I cannot deal with that today. So when somebody says to me, well, Christians are hypocrites, the response I want to make to them is, well, tell me a story in which that happened to you. And in many cases, they can tell you a story. But that's the beginning of a relationship, because I think that the issue here is not trying to defend Christianity. I trust Jesus to defend himself. But my task is to give alternative information to folks who are willing to live with inadequate information. And I can only do that by looking people in the eye and having a relationship with them. And that, I think, one of the great lessons that I've learned over many years, and that is that Christianity as an abstraction can be argued in infinitum, ad nauseum. But the way that I counteract that is building relationship with people over a protracted period of time that, if they're honest, will give them an alternative view. And I will keep doing that even if they refuse to give up their assumption that all Christians are hypocrites. I got to be willing to live with that, but I'm still going to build relationship with them just because.
There's a lot of cerebral power going on up here right now. That was a great answer. And he is staring right into the depths of my soul up here, too. Jeez, my knees. I bet you live on a farm. Anyway, you know, I kid, but to be honest with you, if I can just say this personally, I know I didn't tell you this before, but when I gave my heart to Christ, no one in my family knew Christ. And I remember at first... sharing my faith with my family, the closest people in proximity. Absolutely. I, you know, live with them, and that kid that always goes down to the altar call, and you're like, he just gave his heart to Christ like last week. Why does he keep going down there? That was me. I was going down there to pray for my parents, pray for my whole family. And for weeks, month, years, for 12 years, I prayed for my dad to come to know the Lord, and he has today. But I remember the first time I finally got him to come to my Assemblies of God church with me down in Alabama. And pastor goes, every head bowed, every eye closed. If you want to make a decision for Jesus, raise your hand. And I'm just praying my guts out, sweating. I mean, I'm just, you know, today's the day, Lord. I know you're going to do it. And they say, every head bowed, every eye closed. And, of course, I'm cheating. I've got my eyes open. I'm looking at my dad. And there's not a muscle moves in him. I'm going, man, I'm such a failure. I cannot believe this. And anyway, so we're driving home, and I asked my dad, I said, so, Dad, how'd you like the message? You know, how'd you like the sermon? And he responded to me. He said, he sounded like a real good salesman, but I'm not buying.
Yeah.
And it absolutely broke my heart. And I said to myself, it was one of the defining moments in my life, but I remember saying to myself that I never want to come across as a salesman selling something. Because I saw an interview last night with T.D. Jakes with Larry King. Larry King said, hey, how do you feel selling God, Bishop, you know? And he goes, hold on, Larry, God's not for sale. And I think, you know, I know a lot of times we are representing something, so I understand some of the logic of, you know, selling, but I feel like that we have at times, and when I say we, I include myself, poorly represented all that Christ is and can be. And when we come to grips with that in our own humanity and people who don't know the Lord, oftentimes one of the things they look at is, why would I want to be a Christian when your life doesn't really look much different than mine? I give to charity. You're in debt. I'm in debt. Your marriage is ended. It, you know, it's finished. You know, you've been with, you know, several different people. You know, and I mean, you're struggling just like I. What's the difference? And actually, there's some research that says that on several really critical areas, that oftentimes there's not much difference between a Christian lifestyle and a non-Christian lifestyle. Why do you think that is? How do you think that we can improve that? That's a tough question, but, you know, it's like, what can we do about that?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, it goes back to, and for instance, I'd want to defend the preacher in Alabama, because I think that we are not successes or failures in our communicating the gospel with one slice of the pie. You know, frankly, I want to persuade people to come to Jesus Christ. And if they are predisposed to view me as a salesman, like they would a car salesman or something like that, there's not much I can do unless I have a relationship with them over a protracted period of time. And so in one sense, I understand your, I would never want to be perceived that way. And another, I'd say, you know, that's sort of part of the equation. There is inevitably, you know, in 2 Corinthians 2, Paul talks about the fact that to some we are the aroma of life, and to some we are the aroma of death. And for me, that says that it's more than you win some, you lose some. It's about the fact that we must represent Jesus fairly, and He's in charge of the rest. And I think part of the reason that, you know, we get a bad rap, why the image may be bad, you know, some say, well, the image of Christians is bad. We've got the message right, but the image wrong. And my response is, part of the reason we have the image wrong is we don't get the message straight. And the message these days, I think we need to be much more attentive to what it truly means to follow Jesus. I think that following Jesus is not about adding Him to our lifestyle. A couple weeks ago I preached and had some background on a sociologist at Notre Dame. His name is Christian Smith, who's doing massive research on American adolescents and now young adults. It's basically saying that there's a new understanding of religion in America. And it is, in a sense, centered around ourselves. So in other words, as opposed to the Bible saying we were created for God's pleasure, we have turned that on its head. And in a sense, God becomes created in our image. And so if he doesn't measure up, then something must be wrong. He's inadequate, etc. There's a passage of scripture that for me is like one of the center scriptures of my life. I say, it doesn't matter where I start preaching, I can finish up there. Okay. And it is 2 Corinthians 5:20, which says, "We are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us." And I think one has to ask yourself a rhetorical question, not in terms of one encounter, but in terms of a prolonged relationship. What kind of appeal for Jesus Christ am I making with my life? And the fact that statistics would bear out that social issues and social problems, there's not much difference between people who claim to be Christians and those who don't claim any such thing, is frankly embarrassing. It's frankly, a couple weeks ago, some of you saw a film that my daughter produced, a documentary on domestic violence. One of the saddest testimonies that, frankly, I'm ashamed of is that here we sit in a fairly religious community, and Greene County has more reported domestic violence cases, 2-1, than any other county in the state of Missouri. And the question we have to ask is, how are we representing Jesus? So this is not about image. This is not about, they think we're hypocrites. This is about, like, how am I representing Jesus?
Right.
And if to some I'm the aroma of Christ and some I'm the aroma of death, by God, how over a protracted period of time, what kind of image, what kind of message am I portraying? That's a really big deal. And I think that when we see this kind of, what's the difference question,
right,
we got to look at ourselves as part of the equation. That's the problem.
And as you obviously are interacting with some people who, they don't know Christ either. How have you used everyday life? I mean, I'm thinking right now of just people who are constantly working with folks that don't know Christ. They've been working with them for years. Sometimes things happen. They go through critical instances, and I know some people, because of a bad image, their solution to that is to retract.
Right.
Hey, I'm just not going to say anything, and passive. It's just totally
right,
passive.
Right.
And then, of course, there's another school of thought where it's like, I'm so in your face, mm-hmm. It's a turnoff too. And yet, how do we balance this, that Jesus is totally, he is love, he's compassion, he's all this stuff, but yet he's a very countercultural figure too.
Right.
How do we balance that in our everyday life of interacting with those people in our lives?
Well, I must admit that the first conversation that I have with somebody I meet in this community who's not a follower of Jesus or on an airplane or something like that, my first conversation is not, do you know Jesus? Unless directed,
right.
I am not going to do that, because what I want to do is I want to build a relationship with a person. I want to find common ground. I want them, in a sense, to know me aside from some image that they may portray over me if I say, oh, I'm a Christian. Now, that happens regularly in the community. I've been able to be involved with community leaders. I'm part of a group called the Good Community, and I'm with political leaders. I'm with people from all over the city. And in these kinds of settings, in many cases, I'm the only minister in that room. And frankly, that's not the first thing that I want people to know. The first thing that I want people to know is I care about Springfield just like you do. I care about the domestic violence issue in our county, in our city. I care about the huge poverty issues that we have in this area. I care about the fact that we are almost 3-1 in the state of Missouri methamphetamine cases, busts, over any other state in the union. Well, you take meth, domestic violence, and poverty, I got a lot of talk to talk about people who don't address those issues through a faith lens, but address it through their goodwill and through their way. That's the place I want to start with them. Mm. Now, you know, they find out that I'm a follower of Jesus. They're going to say, man, what? You know, I have city leaders who come up to me and say, how the hell are you doing, Byron? How the hell are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Yeah.
Thanks
to
for
which
asking.
I just laugh. They're just trying to get, you know what? I consider that. That's their backhanded way to say, I know who you are. But I've been able to be in those settings caring about the same things they care about and been able to get a word in edgewise for the motivation that I have to do this. Mm-hmm. I'm not just trying to change statistics. I believe that that victim of domestic violence is made in the image of God and that I care about them because God created them in His image. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of motivations that I have. But I can't do that if the first words out of my mouth are, you know, where would you go today if a truck were to run over you? I mean, that's... Now, frankly, I want to get to that question because for me, that's a very real question.
Right.
Because that encounter I have, that relationship I have, is a life and death relationship. I mean, I got to care about that person's eternal destination. But in most cases, that's not the bridge to getting to that question.
Very good. As you have been listening, hopefully maybe it sparked a question or whatever, and I would give you just a few moments before we go into a few more questions. Begin writing those down, and the guys are going to come around in just a few minutes and pick those up and go through, and we'll start going through them in just a few minutes. If I can just jump back on a topic that you hit, you sort of talked about, you know, our sort of ability to speak to some of the social issues that are going on. It's been my perception that, and specifically here in the life of Central, where we have tried to put the throttle on a little bit, mm-hmm. Or a lot, I should say, with a community involvement, a community awareness. What's your take on now? There seems to be almost a resurgence of that in my limited perspective, even across the country, of getting involved. Good, bad, what are some of the healthy, maybe unhealthy things with that? Maybe you just speak to the issue.
Yeah, I would agree with you that there is increased awareness about what we might say issues of social justice. And, you know, I spent a lot of years involved in those issues in a very direct way. In Latin America, and so I certainly am an advocate for followers of Jesus taking these cultural issues very seriously. I think that while I am a huge advocate of that, I think that we as followers of Jesus need to be very careful about asking ourselves the question, why do we participate in these things, and with what motivation? The reason is that I think that churches need to do more than the Red Cross does well. If all we are doing is nice things for people without bringing them to the eternal questions, then we again have not given people the full message. Why am I, I gave you an example. Why do I feel deeply about the domestic violence issue. Because people are made in the image of God. It's not that it's just bad. It is a shadow on the intention of God who created us in his image. And human beings, through their sinfulness, have in a sense broken people, busted people who Jesus cares deeply about. So while I am an advocate for social justice issues, followers of Jesus need to be careful that their efforts are not just another version of good intention of civic effort. I want to be part of those things. I want to care about those things. But ultimately, my motivation drives me to not different conclusions, but farther dimensions.
Right. That's great. That's a great and a huge. That's a hugely important thing, and I know just giving you a few minutes to answer that may not give it total justice, even for your own. Like he was saying, he worked for Latin American child care and everything else. Well, I want to ask the guys just to start collecting the questions and going through those, and as they do, just one last question before we jump into the Q&A. For you, what are some of the – you've hit on a lot of them, but what are some of maybe your pet peeves, you know, just personally, what do you think are some of the big issues facing Christians today, some of the most critical issues? It could even be bullet points that we need to watch this or, you know, do better at that. Just if you wouldn't mind speaking into our lives a little bit when it comes to those, maybe some of those obstacles we have.
Just a couple of things, bullet points. Between Christians, communicating civilly. Between Christians, communicating. That's a huge issue right now. And I think part of the reason that we don't have civil conversations between Christians, and I'll probably get in trouble for this, but to me this is a huge issue. I think we have to ask some very serious questions about what pervasive technology does to what it means to follow Jesus. Let me give you an example. This is a rhetorical question. Do you say things to people in emails and texts that you would not say to them face to face? That's a very serious question. And if the answer is, I wouldn't dare talk to them face to face the way I talk to them in an email or a text, is there any wonder that between believers we don't act civilly? Mm-hmm. Let alone throw rocks at one another in terms of Christians and non-Christians.
Right.
One of my favorite authors, and I've been writing more about this, one of my favorite authors is what I call a secular prophet. His name is Neil Postman. Again, I referred to him in my message. And he does this massive philosophical thing. But one of his great lines is that people have an infinite appetite for distraction. And I think we've got to ask ourselves, you know, are you saying, are you against technology? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we have to ask the question, those things that are pervasive in culture, how are they shaping us as followers of Jesus? And I think one of the ways that it is impacting us is that we are losing our capacity to look people in the eye and look each other in the eye. And as the Bible says, speak the truth in love.
Right. That's great. In a world who is not following Christ, watches that very, very closely.
Exactly.
Too. I actually heard you say one time, speaking of this very issue, that it's not that all technology is bad. I believe you said something to the effect of, it's that everything in a Christian, there is nothing that should go unchecked.
Exactly.
We should just check it all. And you check right. It against the Word. You check it against, you know, what is the Spirit of God saying to you? You know, it should not go unchecked as a Christian.
Right. Yeah, which is another one of the things that one of the bullet points is that I think that that the sturdiness of our commitment to think biblically and theologically is very important. And those are not just for professionals who have degrees. the question, you know, when thinking biblically, is the Bible a natural default position for you in the issues you face? Thinking theologically is not about some professional speaking in a language you don't understand. Thinking theologically is asking questions about how is God represented in this event? How does God see this? How might God interact with us in this situation? That's thinking. People don't need to be able to read and write to do something like that. And I think that part of the reason that we have not engaged culture well is because we have not mastered the kinds of languages, in the sense of linguistic capabilities, to interact with folks in those kinds of areas.
That's great. Would you say that there is a book that came out, it's been a couple of years, called Unchristian, that came out a few weeks ago, or a few years ago, and we did a series about it in here, and they made all sorts of accusations. Six sort of major objections came up about the way outsiders perceived insiders, if you would. Anti-homosexual shelter, too concerned about converts and all these sorts, judgmental, and too political. Well, do you think, how much validity, I mean, obviously that was research, but when it comes to your perception of how, because I think I personally think the landscape of churches across America are changing. I may be probably wrong about that. I'm wrong about most things. But anyway, so I could be wrong about that. What has been your perception in that? Do you think we are adjusting adequately to culture as a church and reaching culture?
You know, I think regardless of where you come down on that question, yes or no, maybe so, there'd be anecdotal evidence to prove your point. Again, I don't think we will carry the day through adjusting our style. I think followers of Jesus will represent him fairly when we communicate his truth in relationships over a protracted period of time. And the idea that our bands sound like or our technology is as good as, I think that if that's the standard we're going to use, we lose.
Yeah.
And that's not my focus.
I strongly believe that's just... Yeah. There's just something hollow about sitting around talking about, I wish they'd have some heavy metal guitar in there. Then we'd do it, you know. I mean, I just feel like that there's something hollow. I mean, I'm sure it has its place, and you need to be culturally relevant and that. And I do believe in that. But there's something much deeper and such bigger, much greater going on there. I so appreciate you bringing that perception and that perspective to us, that this sort of relational... look, it's relationship is consistently being faithful to the word and to that message that Christ wants to speak through you in that relationship over a prolonged period of time.
Let me just give you just a quick example. When I first came here, it was about 2002, I went to an area, an Islamic Republic, I'll just say that. It is illegal to be a follower of Jesus in that nation. You will die. And I was in there meeting with followers of Jesus. And there are no churches. And I sat cross-legged 8 hours a day drinking tea while followers of Jesus came in and talked and asked questions. And at the end of the day, I'd say, man, we didn't do much today. But after a week of doing that, I realized a great lesson in why I've sort of pushed this eyeball-to-eyeball stuff over a protracted period of time, because that is the way in that nation it has gone from essentially zero followers of Jesus to 1,000 in about 10 years. Now, 1,000 doesn't sound like much, but it is comparable to 25,000 in a church here in the U.S. And that's how did that happen? It didn't happen with any of the accoutrements. It didn't happen with any of the stylistic stuff. It happened through relationship. It happened through drinking tea till, I mean, I was just caffeined out, you know, and, you know, up till 3 o'clock in the morning, finally get to sleep when the mullahs are, you know, calling people to prayer at 3 o'clock in the morning. But that's where I think I saw that straight, that the only way is over a protracted period of time, people observing you, interacting with you, talking seriously with you, and at some point, you being able to ask the question.
Well, we're going to jump into some questions here. And the first one, just because I want no screaming outbursts, he says, if this doesn't make it to him, I will scream. And it says, I love Mike. So I'm moving on.
There you go.
Okay. So, here we go. So many pastors preach on sharing the gospel with everyone we meet in the grocery line, on a plane, that it comes across as, quote, talk about Jesus immediately. And if we don't do that and we're not adequately sharing, we are not adequately sharing our faith. How do we share Christ with people we won't be building a long-term relationship with, or do we? And if we don't live this way, should we feel convicted or guilty about it?
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that there would be people with different opinions about this. When I get in an airplane, I'm not looking for targets. I want to be kind. I want to talk to folks, but I realize that it's an hour, 2 hours, etc. That I would be a kind person, that I would be a generous person, that I would be a kind person, that I would just be somebody that doesn't spill Coke on their lap is a great start. If I get an opportunity, I may ask a rhetorical question. If they don't bite, I'm not going to feel guilty that my encounter did not somehow get the question to them.
Yeah.
I do need to represent Jesus fairly. And that is, in this kind of context, being kind, being generous, and being a nice person.
Right.
And I frankly am not guilty about that. What I would be guilty about is if I sensed God giving me a question to ask that person, and I didn't obey. At that point, I'd have reason for God to come back on me on that one.
And I always pray when I'm getting on airplanes, I'm kind of like, okay, Lord, if you want to use me, just make it plain. And I remember one time I was getting on a plane to go interview somebody. I was just graduated Bible college. I was going to interview at a place. And so I'm praying, Lord, just make it clear. And I sat down next to I got bumped up to first class. And I was next to this young guy of a similar age. And so we're sitting there, and I'm thinking, man, who's this young guy in first class and everything? So I eventually just said, hey, so where are you going? And he said, well, I'm going out to Salt Lake City, Utah. And I said, oh, really? What are you doing? And he said, well, I'm going out there because I'm about to start my two-year journey as a Mormon. What are you doing? I said, well, I'm flying up to Toledo to interview for a youth pastor and start the ministry. And as he said that, and I said what I said, and I go, well, that's pretty clear what I'm supposed to do. So we just started this conversation.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's amazing what the Lord, I think, will do. Even questions, I had no idea, you know, just what in the world to talk about it. You know, I skipped that class, you know, in CBC of World Religion, so I didn't even know anything about Mormon. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
So I...
But in this day and age, when windows like that happen, the end of the conversation or the relationship does not need to be when you walk off the plane. I mean, you know, there is electronic means by which, I mean, if you're really serious about keeping that relationship going, well, there's ways to do that.
Right. That's great. This is a little bit of a departure, but a good topic here. Losing our freedom to worship God, to preach the whole gospel in this country through legislation and, quote, fairness laws. So maybe you just want to speak to the general topic of, you know, fairness, losing our ability to communicate the gospel, and what, I'm not sure if there's a question in there, but maybe what you think about that.
Yeah. Again, I'll take a sort of contrarian approach to that. I think that that would be a fair observation. I would also make the observation that where Christianity is a persecuted minority is where Christianity is growing the fastest. And one has to, you know, when we talk about persecution, those things are very real. But I mentioned to you just as I came in today, I don't know if you've been aware of these two young ladies in Iran who have been jailed for 250 some odd days simply for their faith and their refusal to recant. That's persecution. And thank the Lord for the prayers of faithful believers, they were released today. I just got an email from that area from a colleague, and they were released today.
Wow.
So, I mean, I hear those things loud and clear, and I think that we are suffering the unfortunate consequences of the fact that we have not engaged people over a protracted period of time through relationship. And therefore, stereotypes have allowed to emerge. And frankly, evil does exist in this world. And light and darkness have a hard time handling together. And we are, in this nation, going to face those things very clearly. I think that the question then becomes, how are we going to faithfully represent Jesus? Peter Kuzmich, who's Pentecostal, grew up in the former Yugoslavia, says it is the task of the church to wash the face of Jesus. And he said, growing up in what we call the Iron Curtain era, he grew up in then called Eastern Europe, and he grew up in a situation where religion as a whole was besmirched. Statues in the cities of his country were knocked down, shot at. And he said, the role of a follower of Jesus is to wash the face of Jesus. That is, by our actions over a protracted period of time, by our relationships with people, in many cases returning good for evil, continuing to follow Jesus when injustices will come against us, will wash the face of Jesus. We are not the first people to face persecution, and in comparison to the places where the gospel is growing most rapidly, we have no persecution whatsoever. So I think we have to get a different perspective. Is it true that there could be legislation? There is legislation? Absolutely true. But we live in a day and an age where that kind of reality will force us to ask some serious questions like, what does it mean to follow Jesus? What does it mean to fairly represent Jesus? What does it mean to not cast shadows on Jesus? I think that probably we're going to have a better chance to answer that question than we have had in a long time.
That's great. Really tough questions, and I do not envy you as you are answering them. But why isn't the church more open to the possibility that the second coming will not happen as we think? And I'm assuming that would be before the tribulation here. And yet we don't discuss, this sort of dovetailing on your question, yet we don't even discuss the possibility of suffering through the trial of our faith.
Yeah. That's a really good question. Another example, a couple of years ago I was in an unnamed nation, and there were a number of people who were there who had been imprisoned on a regular basis for their faith. And over a course of lunch, I had this guy ask me a question. So, and he's matter of fact about this. He's not like trying to catch me in some trick question. He says, so how many times have you been arrested for your faith? And he's dead serious. I mean, what am I going to say? Well, I have a couple speeding tickets, had an impact on my insurance, my wife says I should not yell at people when I'm driving, things like that. But he reflected, I think, the fact that suffering, and again, places where suffering is a reality and part of what it means to follow Jesus, are places where the gospel is progressing most valiantly and quickly. Suffering has to be part of our understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. And frankly, we have not done well at that. And, I often say that our understanding of eschatology or end things is much more of an economic issue than it is a biblical issue in many cases. That is, I can remember, and I'm not that old, but I can remember where sermons about the second coming were about like at least once a week. And, you went to bed at night just hoping, just scared. And, little girls would hang on to their mom's dresses, to make sure that if mom went up, they did too. We laugh at those things now. But you know what? There's something precious about the expectation that what God has started, He will finish. And I am not wanting to get into huge arguments about, the seventh toe on this monster that came. I don't know enough, but I do know this, that one of the things that we are missing in the American church today is the realization that God is in charge of history, and history as we know it will come to an end. And He is in charge of that, and we're part of that glorious destiny. And our anticipation of His coming, I can remember preaching sermons on the second coming, preaching, out of the Apostles' Creed, He will come and judge the quick and the dead. And I can remember people saying to me, I've been a Christian for 10 years and never heard a sermon on the second coming. That's a tragedy. It's a tragedy in that it's part of the gospel, that the Creator God is in charge of history, and He will get the record straight, and all the crud that humanity has created will be dealt with on the day of evaluation. That is great news. That's great news. And unfortunately, we have bypassed that because we have created a God, or we have wanted to have a God in our life who fits our lifestyle and our image, and a God who's in charge of history doesn't fit that because it's His agenda, not ours.
That's powerful. Several more questions here, but really two main subjects. The first one is, and hopefully we can get to both of them, what if someone you want to build a relationship with and to witness to dies tomorrow? Wouldn't the urgency of this, of his eternal damnation, wouldn't that need to be addressed first if you truly care about his salvation?
I'll give you an example. I went to the hospital last Sunday to see a guy who was dying. He was a friend of my daughter's. She'd met in her filming and stuff like that. He was a retired preacher who had had some bad raps, and he was a pretty miserable old guy who sort of drank himself into oblivion, got himself in a car accident, and was down at St. John's in a coma. And she asked me to go see him. Now, I went down there, and he was sort of conscious. And in that situation, I said, Bob, you have had a relationship with Jesus Christ in the past. And I said, you've been in an accident. Things aren't looking good. And I'm here because Olivia, my daughter, cares about you. And I'm here simply to say that you may have forgotten God, but God hasn't forgotten you. And I prayed with him. He died yesterday. I do not know whether I got through or not. But that one encounter, while it was important, was also part of a long life in which opportunities and bad situations added up to his life. I'm trusting God. I did my best, and it did do one thing. When I sat and I sat by his bed, I looked into his eyes, I knew that this man was facing life and death. And it was an important deal to me. And every encounter is an important deal like that, but it's also one encounter in a long string of encounters.
That's fantastic. And thanks for being willing to be used that way too with him. Last question, and then I'm just going to have you pray for us, say any final words you'd like. And we have addressed this topic here in Tough Questions, so you don't have to go into it, but it'd just be interesting to hear your take on it. What do you do when someone who has been severely hurt and says there cannot be a God because God is not, how could God be good if he allows bad things, these bad things to happen to me?
It may be trite, but you yourself in that encounter are testimony in flesh and blood that I don't think you want to say stuff like, well, you know, it'll all work out for better, you know, don't worry, God, you know, don't try to counteract that. Don't try to argue them out of that. Simply continue being the bridge yourself through relationship over a protracted period of time, through their just simply yelling at you, them being angry at you. You demonstrate that God still cares for them because you do.
That's good.
And that doesn't sound like much, but I think that's what God calls us to do.
Would you, as we've all been challenged tonight, and we thank you so much for that, would you, as we kind of close, would you pray for us?
Sure.
And pray for the relationships that many in this room have that are, you know, sometimes we localize the ministry to the people on the stage, but my heart and for New Community and the people, the reason why I love this church is because I think the people out there, they get it.
Right.
And they're in the trenches every single day. Would you pray for us?
I do. Lord Jesus, tonight, here are followers of you, people who are in a variety of circumstances all over Springfield and Greene County.
Yes.
They are in places that you have placed them, and in your great economy, you have placed them for such a time as this. I pray, O God, that you would give them a sense of destiny, that you would give them a sense of the fact that you are orchestrating their steps. I pray that when bad stuff happens in reaction to their good intentions, that you'd give them patience. I pray, O God, that they would sense and understand that these encounters and these relationships are important for eternity's sake. I pray you'd give us patience, confidence, wisdom, humility, honesty, and the right words at the right time. In Jesus' name I pray.